Hi, it's Brock Romanek, editor of thecorporatecouncil.net. I'm here today with Jeff Kaplan, who's a founder and partner of Kaplan & Walker, doing our annual program on this one in particular is on board oversight of compliance, a real hot topic. This is the eighth year that Jeff has spent some time with us, either on a podcast or on a webcast. So I want to thank you, Jeff. You always make it easy for me to do these. So, starting off, we're going to focus on the important issue of how to keep the board sufficiently apprised of where they should be going with their compliance program. But there's been a lot of activity here just in the last few weeks. Do you want to briefly discuss the recent FCPA guidance?
Sure. I would say just looking back at the year, which, you know, we always do as part of these our traditional podcast. There are really sort of two big stories this year. One is the DOJ, SEC, FCPA guidance that you mentioned, and it's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of law firm memos, a fair bit of people criticizing it, saying it's not specific enough, but I guess I'd look at it from a different perspective. It's less sort of what's in it as the very fact that the DOJ and SEC went to all the effort they did to articulate for companies and their advisors what good compliance in the FCPA realm means, though it could be applied to a lot of other areas too. And I guess the point I would draw from that is if the government takes this seriously enough to go to this unprecedented effort, then companies need to be that much more serious or attentive to what the government's saying. The second thing that I think we saw in 2012 that's significant is just a continuation of the trend towards ever higher criminal fines. And without going into all the cases, when we started the year, there was only one criminal fine in the $1 billion-plus range, and now corporate criminal fine, and now there are three. So the fact that two of the three biggest fines, including the biggest, VP, happened just in the last year, after some pretty big fines in prior years, shows that the government is really intent on socking it to companies that aren't compliant, and that makes it all the more important for boards to make sure that their companies are paying sufficient attention to this.
So what are the important legal drivers right now for compliance programs?
Well, we really fall into several different categories. Most important are the expectations of prosecutors. Those come out of the sentencing guidelines, out of a set of standards that the DOJ articulated in 2008 that weren't specific to FCPA, that was just sort of general, and even this new guidance that you mentioned and that I discussed, that refers in a number of instances to the important role of the board. Sort of the discussion almost starts out talking about how the directors set the proper tone, the importance of having direct access by a compliance officer to an audit committee, and ensuring that directors are trained on compliance. So just that's one category, but probably the most important one. The second category in terms of legal drivers is Delaware case law, like Caremark and Stone versus Ritter cases most obviously, indicating that boards should have compliance program oversight duties. I'd also throw into that, less obviously perhaps, the Disney case from 2005, not a compliance case, but one which encouraged boards to follow best practices as a way of minimizing legal risks and legal costs, and that, while not a compliance case on it by itself, certainly the logic of that is very appropriate to compliance. And the third are SOX and the New York Stock Exchange rules, which articulate compliance expectations as well with respect to boards. I should also say for global companies that there are expectations outside of the U.S. In some ways, those can be higher. In the U.K., for instance, the Office of Fair Trading issued a guidance book just for corporate directors on how to ensure that their companies have effective competition law compliance programs. So there are a number of drivers, depending on what kind of company you are, but all told, there's a lot.
So what about what sort of information should boards receive to help them put the compliance programs together?
Basically, it falls into two categories. each of which we can discuss in a little more detail. But just the overview is operational information about the compliance program, which is information they get periodically. It's not tied to specific events. And then what might be called case-specific information, such as having to do with a problem emerging involving a senior official or a certain category of wrongdoing that management gets notice of, and their boards, depending on a number of factors, which we can talk about, will get a prompt or immediate, in some case, notification of whatever the event is. So it's really those two things.
So can you drill down into the operational?
Yeah, and they're basically, you know, this is a bit more complex than the case-specific type of compliance reporting. But there are a number of areas that, I should stress, are not mutually exclusive thing. You know, some boards will emphasize receiving some more than others, and some may get all, and, you know, others less so. Every board has somewhat different needs. But one of these categories, I guess you could say, is the elements and attributes of a compliance program, particularly the elements and attributes where a board can make a difference. A board is less likely to be involved in drafting policies or, you know, some of the more prosaic ministerial aspects of a program, but ensuring that, for instance, there's effective discipline, particularly for high-level people if caught in wrongdoing, that the incentives for compliance are right. Those are things where a board really can make a difference. It can weigh in, as well as ensuring that the program has sufficient resources, the compliance officer has authority and independences, which can mean different things. So those are one category of, or that's one category of information that boards receive. A second one, which is, I guess, in a way a subset of the first, but kind of warrants mention by itself, is focusing very closely on the system that the company has for encouraging the reports of violations, whether it's a hotline or some series of mechanisms and procedures. And the reason I think that that warrants special attention is that's really what the heart of the Caremark case and Stone v. Ritter are about, is having a system like that. And obviously that's where the Sarbanes-Oxley obligation comes in. So focusing on that, seeing where the weak spots may be within a company, whether it's a business unit or a particular geography, you know, where isn't a company's compliance department getting phone calls from? That's something that where a board can profitably receive information and respond to it. Sort of related in a way, but a half step different from that, is another category which I guess you could call is receiving program metrics. Things like results of employee surveys on how they feel, how comfortable they feel reporting concerns, or do they worry about retaliation? What are the results of audits into compliance? What are the trends with respect to types of breaches? Are there, or is all the training being completed, compliance training? And so, you know, there's no one number or one question that really matters more than all the others. Again, it's what a particular company's needs are, but I think increasingly you see boards looking for that kind of information. And then the fourth one, which flows a little bit from Delaware case law. In fact, you can, you know, find a basis for it in this new FCPA guidance, is training directors on specific areas of risk, things like anti-corruption, things like competition law or antitrust. And I think that that's an area where, you know, boards need, depending again on the company, many need more information than they're receiving, because it's certainly something that the Justice Department expects companies to provide, meaning training for their directors.
So is this the same type of variation in what you call the case-specific type of information that boards get?
Yeah, not quite as much. You know, there I think what you see is you know, sort of several things that go into deciding what information a board gets. One piece is the person about whom the report is made a corporate officer. So that would typically be something that would prompt an immediate or, you know, timely report to an audit committee. A second would be the potential impact, whether it's a dollar amount or something in terms of sort of a severe reputational impact, that would also go into that factor. And then thirdly, at least for public companies, boards would typically want to get prompt information about accounting and financial reporting and auditing-related violations. So you do find a sort of a, you know, companies approach those differently. They tend to, most companies I'm aware of, factor all three of the things that I just mentioned into sort of a reporting formula. The one other thing I would just say about that, though, is, you know, I've seen at times a kind of a tendency by some general counsel to think that they're doing boards a favor by setting the threshold for reporting at a high place so that the audit committee gets less rather than more information. And I understand that, you know, that tendency, but I think it's one to be resisted. At the end of the day, you're not doing your audit committee a favor by keeping information from them and then with hindsight, they may wish they had gotten. And indeed, it's something which is more likely to hurt a general counsel than help to, you know, be, I guess, overly restrictive in what gets reported. You know, a phone call to an audit committee member is not an imposition. They should want to get a fair bit of information. And so not being overly restrictive, I think, is a best practice.
So how does a company make it all happen, putting this together, and what's the starting point?
Yeah, that's a great question, because a lot of companies have great expectations or the best intentions but don't make it happen. And I think really the key is building it into governance documentation. Now, on some level, every public audit committee's charter talks about this stuff, and I don't know that every company should, even non-public companies, I think. But sometimes that's, you know, more is needed. And the more that I'm talking about doesn't necessarily have to be something that's publicly disclosed. So, for instance, companies will often have compliance program charters, something which articulates all the different elements of a compliance program and all the different responsibilities within it. That goes beyond the board's responsibility, but sort of specifying the types of reporting obligations of both types, you know, both the operational and the case type, is something which can go into there. It can also go into job descriptions of the chief ethics and compliance officer or even the general counsel has a role in this, if that's somebody other than the chief ethics and compliance officer. And finally, I think what you're seeing these days, and it could almost be a separate webcast because it's an important point, is more companies developing investigation procedures. And that's something which has been prompted in 2012, that is many companies adding that in, by the Walmart case, though it has come up in other major cases over the years, including the Hewlett-Packard one of about, you know, 6 or so years ago. So all of those are good places for specifying what the reporting obligations, what the reporting approach is, and having it in those documents is likely to make it happen, particularly, you know, since an audit department will typically go back and look at how investigations are handled, and no one wants a finding that they haven't lived up to what's in their charter. So that's how I would do it.
Well, Jeff, as always, this has been tremendous, great information, and a good way to end the year. So I appreciate your time and look forward to talking to you in 2013.
As always, Brock, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.